It's basketball season, and we've got you covered. The Ringer NBA show breaks down the latest and greatest around the league 5 days a week. Check out the Ringer NBA show on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles, from executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., and based on the Pulitzer Prize winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
Can you turn your mic and go straight? I'm asking you to go straight for first time.
First time in 20 years. Hello and welcome back to the Stadio Podcast and Ring OC. I'm Musa Kwonga.
I'm Ryan Hun.
Ryan, how are you doing?
I am okay, thanks, Musa. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Very
happy good book release day.
Thank you. Yes. Oh yeah, my book is out today.
Oh, this little thing. One of them, an Eton College memoir. Go and buy it.
It's out today. Yeah, available wherever you get your books.
Wherever you get your books.
There we go, yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Yes.
Second book of the year.
It is. It is.
Wow.
Busy lockdown.
Showing some of us up. Thanks, man.
Can't get the vaccine. Might as well get some books out.
If I can't get the Moderna or AstraZeneca, I'm going to inject your book straight into my vein. There you go.
Listen, if I have to suffer, the rest of you are going to suffer. Here's my threat. I'm going to keep churning out books and podcasts until you give my vaccine. So you want to shut me up?
Make it stop.
You want to shut me up? Give me my vaccine. There you go. You heard it here first. Vaccines for everyone, or I'll keep releasing podcasts and books until the end of time.
Oh no!
I won't stop.
Speaking of podcasts,
yeah,
you were on the Ringerverse with Mallory Rubin.
Oh my goodness!
Winter Soldier.
A joy. This was an absolute joy.
Two wonderful minds, Mal and Moose. That is a Ringer podcast waiting to happen, isn't it? Mal and Moose.
You know, her brain is like, it's like talking to a library. You know, like the library, you know those city libraries where you walk in and the librarian knows where every book is. Mm-hmm. Like to the point where you could be like, oh, like I'm looking for the fourth volume of so-and-so's, you know. And they're like, oh yeah, of course. And they're just like, you just see them kind of, it's like Doctor Strange. You see their eyes just flicker. And then the arm just reaches back and they're like, there. And he points like the seventh floor, the fourth corridor. And they're like, it's absolutely there. That's what her brain is like.
The thing I really loved about this, listening to it, because I listened to it yesterday, was that I really loved how the pair of you reacted to what the other one said. And you could hear you both figuring out or processing what the other one had said.
It's so funny.
But never really like pushing back. It was always just like, whoa, okay, what about? Yeah, but actually, maybe you're onto something. What about this? And I was like, find me a podcast with two bigger nerds in a room. Or not in a room, as it were.
Actually, having said that, I mean...
What? Are you talking about Stadio?
Ryan, I mean, if we're talking about nerds, what? You and Mally Rubin are two of the biggest... No disrespect, like you're lovely people, but you're two of the biggest nerds I've ever met in my life.
What did I do? I mean, I'm going to take that as a huge compliment because
it is.
You know, Mallory Rubin's brain is extremely powerful. But I just do a podcast. Leave me alone. If Mallory Rubin was really, really, really into football, we'd be booted off the Ringer in a heartbreak.
Yes, Klingon as it is.
Some admin. Let's do some admin.
Let's do it. Yep, yep.
So yeah, your book is out. Go buy it. I have too many of your books on my bookshelf.
Oh no,
I'm going to have to write a book.
Me too. Yeah.
What's the shortest amount of word count you can get away with for a book?
30.
Who will pub
30,000.
Oh, 30,000? I thought you were saying 30.
Oh, no. I got away with 30,000 just about.
Oh, I suppose that's only like, you know, yeah, it's like 20 odd written pieces.
Actually, no, you can get away with children's book. Write a children's book, you can write 12,000.
Might write a children's book about you.
Oh my God. What, Hansel and Gretel?
Trying to steal podcasts from everyone. He's trying to cancel podcasts.
I've got them all. Do you know what that'd be? a children's story, a supervillain who goes around cancelling things would be amazing.
Yeah.
I'd love that.
Oh my God.
And one by one, he cancelled them all. And to be honest, the Pied Piper of Hamelin is basically the first story of cancel culture in like...
And Stan culture. Times. Those rats, man. They loved him.
They did. They definitely stand. Exactly.
We stand a man who can play the pipe so well.
We stand a Pied Piper.
Anyway, this has gone weird. When does it not? Other bits of admin. You were on Writer's House this week with Jeanette. I had to record this one a little bit earlier, but it was a really good episode, I thought.
So much fun.
That's up on the feed now. If you do listen on an app that allows you to rate and review, please do so. It'd be very kind. I've got a piece going up on Friday on The Ringer about... Okay, so we're going to do an episode on this as well. So we've been planning this for a little while.
Yeah.
But it's basically the 10th anniversary of the four Clásicos in 18 days.
Yeah.
So I've written a piece about the four Clásicos in general. You're doing a piece next week about something more specific.
Yes.
Which we will keep quiet. I think we're going to do Monday's episode about the four Clásicos. So we might swerve the games this weekend actually and do it, because we're thinking, when can we do it? And I think Monday works. I think it'd be really, maybe if there's anything hugely newsworthy, we'll touch on it quickly. But I think, yeah, we'll do Monday's episode on the four Clásicos.
That sounds great to me.
I've rewatched them all this week.
Yeah.
Which was fun and not quite as exhausting as the first time around, but it was exhausting.
It's extremely, I mean, to be honest, when you begin with the first one, it's like, the first one you're like, this is real. You know, like the opening moments of like an action movie where you can see the colors, they've chosen a particular filter and they've chosen the kind of gray, gritty, you're like, whoa, we're going to see some deaths in the first couple of scenes. Yeah, like it sets the tone really, yeah.
But we'll save it for Monday, and what we'll do is we'll go through each game and we'll talk about, because the thing that's so interesting, which I don't want to give the piece away, but for those who don't remember, but they were also bookended by two gigantic Clásicos that were memorable for their own reasons.
Yeah.
So we'll discuss that on Monday. I think that's all the admin. ringer.com/soccer. Check that. Stadio.football if you want to check our website. Stadio Outros playlist with the music that we play out on each episode. Search for Stadio Outros on Spotify. You find all of the tunes we play out on the newest one at the top. Yeah, on a more serious note, today's the 32nd anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster. And I just wanted to mention that we're thinking of anyone who was affected by that, who lost loved ones, and Liverpool fans and the club in general. I think it was something that we'll never forget. I can remember it just about. I can't remember the actual game, but I can remember, like weirdly, I can remember it for the actual event as opposed to the it being a football thing.
Yeah.
But yeah. Just sending love to anyone who today is, you know, pretty difficult for. And I don't know. Anything else you want to add to that?
I just remember the photos. It's strange. Maybe we're in a different time now, but the tabloid photos from the ground. Leppings Lane, Leppings Lane, it's such a strange thing. I was like, I remember you hear it and you think, I'm just never going to forget that name.
Yeah.
I'm never going to forget that name. What's associated with it and the stories that came out and the way they came out and what it did to Kenny Dalglish, what, like four funerals in a day at one point he went to. And just the things that Liverpool as a community is in a club, what that did to them, it's just, it's something else. So yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned that. And of course, about you, thoughts to everyone.
All right, man, let's talk about the Champions League.
Let's do it.
Where would you like to begin?
PSG Bayern.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, I think we have to.
PSG are through to the semi-final.
They lost 1-0 to Bayern, still went through.
They did. Interesting that both games were won by the away side.
Yeah, it is interesting.
And arguably not the better side on the night.
Yeah, I was going to say this. Impressive loss of PSG. An impressive loss. There's another one. Add that to the lexicon.
Impressive loss indeed, because they really should have been home and dry.
They played some beautiful football, actually.
They really did.
They really did, yeah. And the way that Neymar and Mbappe combined in particular was superb. And this is a PSG missing Marquinhos, which is an enormous loss.
Still without Verratti.
Yeah, right. An enormous loss to them. Like two pivotal players. And that is credit to Mauricio Pochettino. who is showing what he can do with resources.
Mm.
And, you know, it's always the thing, isn't it? It was always the kind of the hypothetical. What could Poch do if he had the players? And we saw it the other night. Now, obviously, Bayern were without Robert Lewandowski, but they still had plenty of other tools.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, Lewandowski is obviously going to be a gigantic miss for any club in world football. We know this. I think missing Goretzka in midfield was also really bad for Bayern.
Yes, yes.
They didn't miss Nicolas Sula as much at the back because Hernandez, I think, had his probably the best game I've seen him have for Bayern.
Yeah.
I think he's had a bit of a tough time, Hernandez. He was in and out of the side. He had a massive injury in his first season and has never really been given a sustained run of games in one position. He's either played left back or centre back. And obviously with Alphonso Davies coming in and the emergence of him last season, that meant that he kind of lost his left back spot. With Alaba and Boateng gone, basically, in the summer, you're looking at him and Upamecano probably as the two.
The problem was for Hernandez that in a full strength team with players of their ages, he was not the first choice.
Mm.
He wasn't over Davies, who maybe got the jump on him. Maybe Davies' progress startled a lot of people, which happens at Bayern. People leap the queue. It's a competitive club. And then I think with Boateng being in the middle, it was really one for the future. And I think he would have been told, I suppose, you know, wait this one out.
Mm.
Your time will come. If there's any club at which you can wait things out and get your time, it's Bayern, actually, because they're pretty good at that. They're pretty good at
Alexander Nubel energy. That guy is waiting and waiting and waiting.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And also they're patient with you. If they think you can do a job at Bayern, they keep. Look at Xavi Martinez. That guy's been renewed and he's been through everything.
Yeah, and it looked like he was off last season.
That's the thing. If they feel they can still use you, they keep you around, which is why when Bayern sell, you need to be worried.
That's the interesting thing about Boateng, because it's pretty publicly known that Hansi Flick really wanted to keep him. There have been a number of things that I think him and Salihamidzic have fallen out on, and I think that was one of them. Salihamidzic wants him gone, or doesn't want to renew him, basically. And Flick wants to keep him around. There's a lot of, maybe we'll touch on it later on in the show, but there's been the first, or the, I suppose the second big domino in the Bundesliga managerial, I don't know, Royal Rumble.
Well, yes, that's right.
It's fallen with Adi Hütter going to Gladbach, which was kind of, it's been whispered around for a while now. But yeah, let's touch on that a little bit later, maybe if we remember. Back to this game. Do you think over the two legs, the best side went through?
Oh yeah.
Yeah?
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think PSG were rewarded for their enterprise. Let's not forget the narrow offsides that cost them in both legs, actually. Cost them further goals in both legs. It just had the firepower. And I think, for me, it's not so much about territorial dominance, about who's most enterprising. At this stage of the Champions League, it's about who plays on the front foot. You know, we're not in a time where you grind out, you know, 1-0 aggregate, 2-1 aggregate. This is about firepower. And PSG showed the most ambition, and that's why they're through, and they deserve to go through, I think. I don't think Bayern can really complain too much, especially when you look at key players of theirs who struggle to make the impression. You look at sort of Kingsley Coman and Leroy Sané, and replacing Arjen Robben and Frank Ribéry was always going to be so difficult. And the thing about Leroy Sané and Coman, who, you know, did score the Champions League winner last year, so still props to him, they all have like elements of those great wingers.
Mm.
And the problem is, obviously, if you're just 20% short of devastating effectiveness on the flanks, you're going out. And I just feel like Bayern were 20% short of execution. And that's all it really was. You know, Sané got some superb positions on the flank, cut inside well, went outside maybe less than he should have done. I think the one thing with Sané is, maybe I would say, it really hurts him being on the right flank. I don't think that works, to be honest, Ryan, because he was most devastating for City on the left. And the problem on the right is he just doesn't like going outside on the right that much. You know that eventually he's going to come in at some point, where there are some wingers who, the reason they're so devastating when they come inside is because they will attack on the outside. You know, if that makes sense? And these are tiny margins. It's not like these are big deals, but it's like in games like this, you just need an extra gear and Bayern didn't have it.
But saying that, who was a notoriously one-footed player who played on the right wing wearing the number 10 shirt for Bayern not too long ago.
But he could go. He could go out though. He would attack the right. He would attack the right, which is why he was also dangerous. He would cut, and you never knew when he was going to cut. This is the thing. It's not about being off bottom footed. It's about, I think, it's about predictability. I think, like, if they know, like Mahrez as well. Mahrez like doesn't use his right that much. Mahrez does attack the right touchline a lot.
Just, I mean, I'm not disagreeing that I think that Sané is probably more efficient on the left.
Mm.
I think Serge Gnabry is usually better on the right because he's more two-footed as well, and I think he gives you options. I just wonder whether Davies on the left-hand side maybe gives managers or gives Flick a little bit of thinking in terms of where he wants everyone to kind of be, whether he wants the overload on the left and whether that's possible with a Sané and a Davies.
Yeah, because Davies just basically engulfs that flank. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think maybe with someone a little bit less mobile on the right hand side, like Pavard, for example, it makes more sense.
Him to do the heavy lifting. Yeah. But again, these are small margins. I mean, you look at like, you know, I only say this because it'd be difficult for Bayern to look at what they really did wrong in quote marks, because they came very, very close. Like Thomas Müller, very good effort close in. Kimmich again, just superb driving everything forward. This isn't one of those ones where you look back and go, we really screwed up here, guys. Like,
I think the first leg, like Flick was on Sky Germany afterwards and he was talking about, he gave a really emotional interview actually, where he just kind of, I touched on it a little bit, but before that he was saying that it was basically the third goal. He was like, the third goal in the first leg was the one where it kind of killed us in a way. If they'd gone to Paris with, you know, a 2-2 draw, then I think he would have felt far more comfortable. But I think he just said that third goal was just too much. Lothar Matthäus actually like did really well as well. He kind of just dangled a little bit of a carrot out there, and Flick just spoke about how he just basically gave this massively emotional speech about like Bayern and the job and decisions and stuff like that. And I mean, then Matthäus kind of confirmed, he said that he's off to the DFB to coach the national side after Jogi Löw, which I don't think is any surprise to anyone.
Look at the mileage they put on this year. They won the treble, then he goes off to Qatar, they win the World Club Cup, and they come back and they win, they're in top head of the league. They've put on, there's a lot of intensity, and then he had to turn that team around. Like, he's done a lot with Bayern in a very, very short time, and I can see how that would be exhausting.
Yeah, and this Bayern isn't as strong as last season. They've had some rotten luck with injuries, and I know they're Bayern and people will have little sympathy, but it's not a particularly ruhig, as they say in Germany, like not particularly calm environment.
You know what it is?
Bayern, it's like, especially you think of the personalities that you've got there, you've got like, even if you're Hansi Flick, who I think has done a really, really amazing job, obviously he's an ex-Bayern player.
Yeah.
But you've got Salihamidzic on the bench with you. And then up in the stands, you've got Rummenigge, Hoeneß, and Oli Kahn. And it's just like, well, yeah, you're going to go to the DFB and what? Just have to deal with Oliver Bierhoff.
Yeah, it's almost like, and you need to, the thing about being a manager I'm very sympathetic to is you have to be able to assess when your market value is high.
Mm.
Because it varies, of course. And they always said, it's at Bella Gutmann, the third season is fatal.
Mm.
The old Benfica coach, the third season is fatal. Two amazing years, and the third year, players begin to work you out. The team is fully yours. The squad is yours. No matter what happens, you know, it's basically on you. So already prepping your next move. And I think Flick has, you know, if he does go to Germany, take the Germany job, well, which is, you know, basically everyone's saying it, it's a job beautifully done. No shame at bowing out at this point to a team that may well go on and do it because they've got the goals in them. Yeah, I think hopefully he'll look back when things are a bit calmer and just be like, I did a great job there.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you think, I don't know if we have to remind people, but when he came in,
well, I think we do have to remind them because it's been Bayern, a while now. Actually,
Bayern were a total mess. Like Kovac got fired after that defeat to Eintracht, and we looked at that Bayern side, and I constantly reference this. We had a question at the time from someone who said, you know, if you could take one team from one league and put them in another, who would it be and where would they finish? And we genuinely said, and I don't think this was a massively wild hot take at the time, that what was this, October?
Yeah.
October 2019?
Just been beaten 5-1 by Eintracht as well.
And we looked at what was going on there and we looked at the cohesion and we were like, they'd struggled to finish in the top four in the Premier League.
And that was absolutely right.
At that point. And I don't think...
That's absolutely right.
And I remember seeing a couple of Bayern fans talking about it and they were actually saying like, what do you think? As opposed to, this is bullshit or whatever. To then turn them around into the most sleek, flawless looking side in Europe within a matter of months was pretty great from Flick. And I remember saying a number of times that I think his what he did really well at the beginning was just kind of put square pegs back in square holes.
Right, yeah, he did, yeah.
And by doing that and making people feel a little bit more comfortable, I think he just allowed Bayern to like move further up the pitch. And that was key for them because Kovac was sitting a little bit, his Bayern sides would sit a little bit deeper. But I don't think Flick only put square pegs in square holes. He's someone who really got the club. Like I think Kovac does as well because Kovac was at Bayern, but I think it was a different thing. Kovac was at a different point in his career where I think he kind of wanted to flex a bit as a manager, which is totally fine. I think that if Bayern were kind of, I think Kovac was kind of like wrong guy at the wrong time, really.
Also, let's not underestimate how much Hansi Flick's work with the Germany national team would have helped.
Yeah, definitely.
We're forgetting hours of conversations in the canteen, the DFB camp, like, you know, during World Cup campaigns, European campaigns, Flick just on the coach there, talking to Boateng, talking to Neuer, and he arrives and immediately Boateng, Neuer, Müller will be on board and be like, that guy knows. That guy knows at least what it is, what it's like inside a championship environment, which I think is reassuring. You need that.
Yeah,
and I mean, like Bayern, it helps to have that gravitas.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously he was there as assistant before. He didn't just come into Bayern. He was there as an assistant to Kovac. And it was really strange, actually. I mean, he arrived in the July and by November he was in charge. So, I mean, let's talk about PSG a little bit because I think in this game they were absolutely superb. And there was one moment which I think some of the football they played was just... Was that bit on the... It was in the second half where Neymar kind of takes out Kimmich and Müller with one move and then spreads the ball out wide. I think it was, or plays it off to someone. It's clipped to Di Maria who does that chest and then pulls it left.
Oh my
past
God.
Hernandez,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
Squares
yes.
it and it's just out of reach for Neymar. But the thing about this move that is so good, it's such a good move that even Jerome Boateng does like a no look drag back heel out of play for a corner. Even the deflect, even the defending has got like sauce.
Someone said it was existential. Yeah. Someone said it was that existential. You know, and can I shout out Paredes, who is brilliant, who doesn't always get the props. Di Maria's passing through the heart of midfield. This quarterfinal stage, I saw some of the best passing through the middle of crowded areas that I've seen in a long time. Di Maria was hammering the ball through the smallest gaps. It was it reminded me of his 2014 run when he was playing what was the midfield three a bit deeper for Real for quite a bit of that season and was just, you know, you can plug him in anywhere pretty much in that front five, I would say, like either the wings and then like anywhere in the front three if he had to. And he was unbelievable. Receiving the ball in tight spaces, turning and then just like breaking lines with the passes. Honestly, like this was as good. This Di Maria was, in his own way, was as good as I've seen him, I thought, the other day. And not because he was playing this destructive role. You know, he can be the wrecker. You know, we've seen him do that. But this was something else. This was the more contemplative, ball retention, keep possession, get hard the pitch, keep tempo, and routinely beat his opposite men, routinely. And never got greedy, like after the... You can imagine like a training video of like, now listen, you young wingers, this is how you do it. You beat a player, you don't get greedy. You beat a man. And it was actually the Leo Messi thing. Like Messi did this amazing where Messi would get the ball, beat a player, and then hammer it square, and then run on to create another option. And Messi would never get greedy. One man and then go. It was almost like he was on a diet, like your vitamins. Like don't take more than one vitamin a day. Like beat your man.
Whatever you need,
and,
go.
Yeah. And, yeah, exactly. And
it's minimalism.
Exactly. If this is why Di Maria is one of my favorite big game players.
Yeah, you really love Di Maria, huh?
Yeah, it's just because injury is the only thing that stopped that guy.
I saw a lot of Di Maria slander going around on
course.
There was a lot of like calling out individual players this week, which I don't really like. I never really got the Choupo-Moting slander anyway, and we covered him in detail last week. He got another goal.
Yeah.
A goal in both legs in the Champions League quarterfinal against PSG. Yeah, he's never going to be a Lewandowski, but it's like we said last week, you know, you need role players in an elite squad.
Yeah.
So you need these players, and I think he's... I just really love him. I think he just comes across really well when he's interviewed as well. And he's just someone who is just there doing a job. And he knows that when Lewandowski comes back in, he's going to go on the bench. And
absolutely, yeah.
He'll play minutes in the Pokal. And he might play 20 minutes here and there in Bundesliga games. But like you can imagine, for example, Choupo-Moting is a very popular member of the Bayern squad.
Right.
And that you would be hard-pressed to find someone to say a bad word about him. Like those kind of players usually are like that within the squad. And I think that's always a really interesting gauge.
I love that dynamic. Yeah, I love that. I loved.
Like, for example, there's a lot of stuff at the moment about Granit Xhaka at Arsenal and actually the fan relationship to the player, to the player's relationship to the player is an interesting one. I think actually someone like Granit Xhaka is way more integral to that Arsenal squad than he gets credit for.
Yeah. There's a thousand things. Yeah, there's a ton of things. It'll be like, that player helped me get settled. That player did shooting practice with me. That player helped me practice 1-2s. And there'll be improvements in other players' games that are due to a player who might struggle on the pitch from time to time because of the job they're given.
But like, not even that. I think just like reliability. I think one of the things that players love is reliability. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, maybe he's not, you know, Lewandowski level, but like Choupo-Moting is always there when we need him kind of thing.
Yeah.
Always giving the effort, always, you know what I mean? Like we've covered this last week, so I don't want to go into it too much.
But it's just one of those ones where like there'll be coaches, they'll be like, if everyone gave me what that player gives me, we'd win everything.
Yeah.
You know?
So PSG are going through, as are Chelsea, who lost, but still go through.
Yes.
To Porto with an absolute Traumtor right at the end of the game.
Yeah. Stunning strike.
If it had come earlier, it would have made things extremely interesting.
Yeah.
But other than that, it was probably the most low-key of the two. I mean, Taremi's goal was the high point of a game that wasn't particularly wild.
Yes, he's the first Iranian player to score in the Champions League quarterfinals.
No way.
Mehdi Taremi, first player to score in the Champions League quarterfinals. Absolutely amazing. There'll be a statue to that goal. I mean, it's such a beautiful strike. And it's a strike that deserves crowds. That's the thing, isn't it?
Yes.
And Mendy's face when that went in. Do you know what? Can I say this? I love an offended goalkeeper. I love an offended goalkeeper because I'm like, I love how much it matters. That's how much it should matter.
And he's so chill. We said before how chill Mendy is, right?
But it's in there. It's always in there. It's always in there. And every goalkeeper's got it in them. A goalkeeper must take personal offense to every goal that is scored against them, whether it's in a practice, whether it's a five-a-side, it must be a personal offense. And I love it. I love that for him. And it came, I think, like sort of 30 seconds before the final whistle or whatever. But Chelsea done pretty well until then. What I love about this result is it keeps both teams honest. It's a great end for Porto because they acquitted themselves superbly throughout and they were a danger to the very end. So I think they went out in a way that was true to their style, their tradition. And I think it's also interesting for Chelsea because Chelsea are still, I mean, it's still Porto. Porto, a very good side. Let's respect that. Chelsea need a little bit more unlocking for me to look at them as they're not the favourites for this trophy, but they'll need to unlock a little bit more to get through the semis, I think. They'll need to unlock a little bit more.
Props to Thomas Tuchel. Props to Chelsea. They're into their first semi-final, I think, since, is it 2014? So props to Thomas Tuchel. Is they going to do this thing where, are Chelsea going to win the Champions League again after firing the manager mid-season?
It would be perfect if they did. A Chelsea 1-0 win in the final. This season's got that written all over it. Even if that doesn't happen, there are so many universes in which that's the outcome. It just has Chelsea 1, 22-minute winner.
Yikes.
And then Chelsea just hold out. Incredible defensive performance.
Yikes.
Thiago Silva defending on his, like, you know, last unbroken bone.
Oof, blimey.
You can see it though, can't you?
I can see anything.
Yeah.
All right, man, let's go to the Westfalenstadion, where Jude Bellingham gave Dortmund a 1-0 lead with an absolutely superb goal in another absolutely superb performance. He is the real deal. We've spoke a lot about him recently. I want to also caveat that though by saying he will experience a dip of form soon and he will hit a bit of a plateau before progressing to another level, I think.
Yeah.
Because that's just natural. Manchester City going through in the end thanks to Riyad Mahrez's penalty and a lovely Phil Foden goal.
Yeah.
I think Dortmund did themselves, they can come out of this with their heads held high. I think, you know, missing Jadon Sancho, I mean, the gap in terms of resources and squad depth and everything like that, I think that they really did hold their own. I think they had a couple of other chances. They had that one actually not long after they'd gone 1-0 up from Akanji from the corner, the header.
Yeah.
I watched it again this morning and I think that now looks like a really big chance. If that goes into 2-0, Dortmund are ahead in the tie. I mean, it's a lot of what ifs. They are. Yes, there are.
You know what it was? You know what it was? And you're completely right. It was a big miss. And at the same time, the sustained intensity of Manchester City after half time blew me away.
Yeah.
Like, it was absolutely amazing. They were deep in the final third. They were wide. They stretched the play everywhere. And the speed of the passing, the movement was absolutely spectacular. And
they had that, sorry to cut in, but they had that moment after the goal where they really peppered Dortmund's goal. And Bellingham had that one cleared off the line. But he was like celebrating.
He'd scored. It was incredible.
Energy's amazing. Picture of his celebration with the energy looking at the camera.
Yeah. But he deflected. He was going to stay in those trenches for a full night.
But the fact that
he was
happy. Half-time.
Yeah.
Unscathed, basically, was so big.
Wasn't itself remarkable? Yeah. And because, you know, actually, that has to get credit because Dortmund get a lot of criticism for, in quotes, mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed all of it. Again, this is an impressive loss for Dortmund, weirdly enough. If you look at De Bruyne's strike that hit the bar.
I know.
That was rage.
He was amazing,
that was
man.
Actual rage.
He was
from
unbelievable.
De Bruyne.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was everywhere in this game. You know, deep, up top, the false nine, inside left, inside right. He was outstanding, yeah. And I just thought, I don't know, like the things that Dortmund are criticised for in this game, they didn't do them wrong in this game.
Mm.
They made City take it. And that is the greatest compliment to a team that loses is that you made the opposition win it. You made them come out and score, you know, a contested penalty. That was an extremely, extremely harsh penalty. And I saw some criticism of M.A. Chan. And
yeah,
first of all, the sustained pressure that City put on meant that something would give in some way, whether
did,
it was a kind
think,
of contested
sorry,
penalty.
Just to circle back a bit, but did you think the penalty was harsh?
I did, actually. I did, to be honest. It's one of those ones, you know when you say of a penalty, I've seen them given. Mm. That's the definition of a hard penalty. Yeah, whenever someone says about a penalty, I've seen them given, it's like, yeah, that was a bit tough. Like, there are games where that doesn't get given.
I think the thing for me is that the law is obviously very clear in its wording. I think it's the interpretation of what is a natural or unnatural position, because I think the thing, like you try leaning
falling
without
your arms, yeah.
with your arms tucked into your body. Like I tweeted that, is handball ever really a handball anymore, apart from when it is, but who knows when that is? I was feeling very just like, I really don't really know what's going on anymore. Like with the VAR thing we didn't even mention it, but Mbappe scored that amazing goal that was then given offside.
Yeah.
And it's like really weird. You're seeing like, because of they're not flagging for offside anymore until the end of the phase of play. It's like, you're seeing like a seminal moment play out in real time and then it just gets erased. So it's like
stunning
super weird
well.
Psychologically
yeah.
because you're seeing iconic goals play out in real time. You're actually seeing them happen before your eyes. But then they will never really pop up on any highlight reels because they weren't actual goals. So it's like they sit in this weird, like almost like purgatory. Like
and it's funny because that would have been part of Mbappe legend to score two goals, to score two goals of that quality in either, you know, to score a goal of that quality in either leg, because his goal in the first leg, you know, the one that Flick talks about, that is a goal that quite literally only Mbappe can score. We saw him score similar. I mentioned it before in the World Cup final. And again, that was the one that clinched it, took them 4-1 before Lloris had his existential moment. You're right. That Mbappe VAR disallowed goal was, it would have been on highlight reels for years to come because it was such an emphatic dismissal. It was like all this conversation about, this goalkeeper intimidates these players and Mbappe just going, no, this is how you finish when 3-1-1. And it was a joyous finish, you know, for an elite forward to finish with joy like that. You're like, this person's peaking. This person's not afraid of anything except history maybe. And Yeah, just for me, the Mbappe disallowed goal, just very quickly. My frustration with super fast forwards who don't stay like a yard deeper.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know what I mean? I know it sounds harsh, but I've seen it a lot this season. Like, it just happens a lot where they're so fast, they can afford to hold their run.
Mm. It was extremely close.
Yeah, but he's so fast, though. Like, you can eat up the ground. You can afford to be, like, 3-4 feet back. The only reason I say it is because there's lots of extremely fast forwards who have held the run.
I think though, I would also give credit to Jerome Boateng because he knows what's happening and he steps up.
Mm.
Yes, I agree with you in theory, but also I think sometimes, you know, Jerome Boateng is a wily old fox and then he's been around defensively. You know, he knows how to defend.
There are some defenders for whom stepping up is like a first touch. Like, yeah. It's a thing where almost...
It's automatic. You know,
then there's a compilation video of like really great step ups and like people are caught offside, but that'd be brilliant, like chess moves.
Well, it's like that old Arsenal back four, just instant hand in the air.
I think this is even harder these days because now it's 1-on-1.
Yeah.
Now you are the back line, you know, like now you're the centre back. And do you know, I know this is a bit of a silly point I'm making, but it'd be fascinating if anyone's made a compilation video of brilliant last line defending where someone steps up and there's an offside. And just the look on the forward's face of like offside and the little smirk the defender's face going, gotcha.
Let's go back to the Westfalen.
Yes.
I saw a couple of tweets. Well, first of all, it's Man City's first semi-final in 5 years in Champions League.
Yeah, in the quarterfinals of Champions League at City, Pep keeps running into players or teams who have a sense of destiny.
Like Lyon.
And it looked like being Bellingham. It looked like being Bellingham.
Yeah, it did actually.
It did. He was really asserting himself. Like someone said, was it Jeanette? We were talking actually. Jeanette was like, yeah, how much has he been thinking about scoring that since the first leg?
Poor Moda Hood missed it. He was on the deck trying to roll around for a penalty after being clobbered on the spot. And then he kind of, there was an amazing bit where like he looks around. If you watch the goal again, he looks around, realizes the ball's got in and he sees everyone kind of running behind him and he tries to style out a bit of a slight limpy run. Because he was just like, because he really did like go down. I mean, I actually think he got clobbered. It could have been a penalty actually if Bellingham hadn't put it away. But no, I think he's passed every test that he's had this season, Bellingham.
Yeah.
I think you can simultaneously say that he is absolutely the real deal and he will probably become, I don't know what his ceiling is. It's so high. However, he's going to plateau for a bit. We've seen it with all of the kind of great young talents, maybe bar Messi in the last 20 years. I think he's probably the only one who didn't, I don't think.
Yeah, right. Messi never plateaued, you're right. Scary. Scary.
we're going to see it with Phil Foden, who was, again, absolutely brilliant. And this is the thing I'm super excited about. Actually, so shouts to Cara Head. She wrote a tweet saying England are going to be unbearable if they ever win the World Cup. Mm. And she's kind of got a point because the hype around this, I think the thing that's so great about this crop of young England players is that they are all of the profile of players that we have looked to other countries with massive envy before and been like, wow, why didn't England ever produce players like that? Really, you know, on the whole.
Yes.
I mean, you look at the dynamism, like a Rice and Bellingham midfield is... You know, in say in 4 years' time, if they continue to both develop at the rate that they have done, it's absolutely terrifying.
It's brilliant, isn't it? It's got everything. Yeah.
With Foden, with Sancho, and then you've got Raheem Sterling.
Greenwood off the bench.
Hopefully Dominic Calvert-Lewin deep in his mid-20s, firing home goals. Like,
if Reece James up in the mix.
You've got so many numbers of genuine quality there.
Callum Hudson-Odoi.
We haven't even mentioned him. Mason Mount. God. We didn't even mention Mason Mount or Jack Grealish.
Oh my God. Oh my goodness.
I mean, I'm never one of these people who thinks it's hashtag coming home, but the England squad is developing into something extremely exciting. And I think that's because
it's extremely exciting. Yeah, yeah.
I think that's because of the type of players that they have and also just the skill set. I think that, it's really exciting. I think Bellingham will probably be managed a little bit more harshly in terms of minutes and game time for England than he will be at Dortmund because he's just, I think with the Witzel injury, it's just meant that he's played way more and he's proved that he can be there. Like he went toe to toe with Man City and wasn't afraid. Was one of the best players on the pitch at 17 years old.
In both legs.
Should have had a goal in the first leg, which could have changed everything.
Got an even more beautiful one. Yeah. And now he'll have a goal. This is the thing. If he'd scored in the first leg, we would not have a wonder goal. We'd not have an iconic goal.
True. Yeah.
He basically scored the equivalent of a fadeaway jump shot past Edison.
It was a controlled angry goal, I think. It visually wasn't an angry goal, but I think emotionally it was an angry goal.
It's really amazing because I can't remember a period where I was really excited by an England talent and then another one came along who was potentially even more exciting. And it kind
another,
of went...
And another.
And yeah, the order almost went like Sancho, Foden, Hudson-Odoi, Bellingham. That was the rough order of excitement and going, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, like each time. And then you've got Mount and Greenwood right up there in the mix as players who are doing great stuff. Of course, but James, I mentioned before, and Rice, it's just...
And I'm going to throw in Bukayo Saka as well, who we haven't mentioned.
Saka has been... And also the burden that Saka's carried, like it's just... It's all vibes. It's all good.
They could be a problem, man. England, if they get their shit together. Okay, the final tie. Real Madrid, whose 0-0 draw at Anfield was enough to see them through. I expected a little bit more from Liverpool, I think, but this is just something that Real Madrid turn into another being at this point of the season. It's almost like they're on automatic.
Yeah, yeah.
Learned behaviour.
And they love, you know, here's the thing as well. There's a part of Zidane for whom the 0-0 was the ideal result.
Did you see his face when Casemiro absolutely floored Milner?
No, I didn't. No.
There was a shot where like Robertson stands up and squares up to Casemiro and Zidane's in the background out of focus just with the biggest grin on his face.
Wow.
It was very like Joker energy actually because, I mean, to be honest, I actually think Casemiro should have gone for that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
He was nowhere near the ball. He was so late. He'd been limping literally 10 seconds before that. 5 seconds before that, he was limping when he then decided to sprint over and make a move on for Milner. I mean, this is the thing that's wild about like bookings in a way, is that Robertson got booked for squaring up to Casemiro. So he got the same punishment that Casemiro did for the tackle on Milner, which was so dangerous, I thought. It was so late. He could have seriously injured Milner.
Casemiro, I reckon he's one of those players in the squad that is like... I reckon long after he retires, he's the kind of player, if he's passed through Madrid, Zidane makes all the time for. He like clears his schedule for. I think he's that kind of player.
He's naughty, Casemiro, you know. His little cute face lets him get away with absolute murder.
Oh yeah, no, I definitely see that. He's always had that energy in him because he turns up and Real just start winning and they don't stop. Mm. I'm always really fascinated by players who Real Madrid scout really young from the Brazilian game. Because if you think about it, Real are really amazing at scout. They've got a really good record at scouting players from the Brazilian league and putting them straight into like the deep end. They love it. And because they know exactly which qualities they're looking for.
Mm.
And like, they don't play in front of massive crowds. A lot of these, like, you know, to take Casemiro and put him like, we're going to put you in front of 80,000 people a week, 100,000, and it's going to be no big deal. And he's like, yeah, I'll do it. And it's just been doing it at that level for a long time. And a lot of people give him a lot of stick for, you know, sometimes good reason. Sometimes positionally, he's not always the most disciplined, but he just knits that thing together. He knits that midfield together time and again. And it was funny that Salah had a miss early on.
Mm.
It was a deflected pass square from Mane after about 2 minutes, I think. He hit it low without sufficient power or placement and Courtois got his legs across to it. It was actually a decent save from Courtois. It wasn't a horrifying miss. I wasn't watching this game live, so I had to like watch it later, catch up with it later. It wasn't a horrifying miss. In context, I think it was a subpar piece of finishing, if that's fair. And I think the problem is that if you score then, it enables an onslaught. And Real did pretty well at minimizing chance creation for Liverpool. If you think about it, like Liverpool had good chances, but they were kind of stretched out. They didn't arrive in clusters. It wasn't like City Dortmund where City were peppering like, you know, 3 and 5 minutes. It was like Madrid managed the game quite well. And one thing I would say as well, I was mentioning this to Carl and you guys the other night about pressing Madrid. And it's so interesting. If you look at the teams that have beaten Real this year, Alcoyano in the Copa del Rey, mm-hmm. and Shakhtar twice, mm-hmm. and Shakhtar like with all those COVID absentees, and it's teams that have absolutely shown no respect at all to Real, and they've gone right, as I talk about, right down the throat.
You got to rough them up, man.
Yeah, a little bit. Does that make sense?
Gladbach did a pretty good job.
Gladbach was spectacular against them. And I remember watching this in the Champions League going, you've got to put them out now. And I remember, I said, we've all said it. I was like, you've got to put Real out now. If you allow them to creep through, they'll do what they do. And they've done what they do. They're like those baseball teams that go through the entire season winning like 0.550. They scrape into the playoffs. They get a wild card. And then once they're in the playoffs, it's like game time. You see it time and again in baseball, which I used to follow quite closely. Mm. Weirdly, back in the day, I used to follow baseball a lot. And you'd see it time and again. The teams with the outstanding regular season record would just be out of energy by the playoffs. And I think with Real, it's happened so often. I don't think it was even that much of an accident. I think they got a little bit lucky this year with all the kind of things happening.
Mm.
But I think generally speaking, they are a team, I think now, that manage themselves early in the season, just like stay in the hunt. Because we've seen them do it in the league. I mean, they had a bad start in the league.
Dude, they could end up winning a league and European Cup double this season.
Double, yeah. If you'd said that at the start of the season, if you said that after five games, I'd be like, no way. But the one tweet I regret not sending.
One?
Yeah, a month ago. Actually, there's two tweets I regret never sending. The first one is, last year I was going to tweet, I think Prince Harry is going to leave the royal family on a free transfer. Ooh. That was the first thing, because I clocked that. The second thing I regret not tweeting was a month ago, and I was like, this is shaping up to be the most Real Madrid season ever. In a season of pure chaos, it would make total sense for them to win everything they could.
Mm-hmm.
The house always wins, and the house is Real.
If they won the Champions League this season, would that mean that Zidane has won the Champions League four times with not the best team in Europe?
It would, and it would also be wild, because it's like, if anyone had ever said to you when Zidane was at his peak, oh, that guy is going to win more as a manager than as a player, everyone would have laughed.
I know.
Everyone would have laughed. They'd be like, no, there's no way in hell that man, oh, four Champions League. No, please, what, more than Ancelotti, more than Paisley? What? No, come on.
Would you bounce if you were Zidane after this season? So how many times do I need to come back and save you guys? Go and take the French job after the Euros.
I mean, what was it someone tweeted? David Rudin, shout out to David Rudin. I love this tweet. Zinedine Zidane is the best international manager who's never been an international manager.
Yeah.
This take was so brilliant. I had to say it on the podcast because I'm like, it was so brilliant. Just a great, great, great piece of analysis. He's completely right. He just has that energy, doesn't he? And he understands the squad and how to manage and who to trust. Bring in Valverde as right back.
Oh, Fede.
And having used Vasquez there before.
I love Fede.
Love it. Love him. Brilliant.
Okay, so we've got the four semi-finalists. As a complete neutral, I really would have loved to have seen one of Dortmund, Liverpool, Porto, maybe not so much Bayern, but maybe even Bayern go through.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I think the quality of the football in the semi-finals is going to be incredible. I don't think from a purely elite level footballing spectacle, I don't think we can complain.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Who do you think will go through in the semis?
I think the best teams will go through, Ryan.
Give me an answer.
That's my answer. That's not sitting on the fence. The best teams will go through.
I was trying to fish you out by being like, give me an answer. I wanted you to say PSG, and then I was just going to be like, oh, I don't know. I have no idea.
Exactly. I know. You know you too well.
154 episodes. He's learned.
We've got him.
I need to quit. That's it. I've been rumbled. I have no idea. I've no idea. Yeah. Genuinely don't have any idea. Yeah, because they're not as cut and dried as they were last season, I don't think. So,
No. Really not.
We said we'd maybe mention it quickly, but about the Bundesliga merry-go-round, but maybe we'll save it.
Yeah, let's save it. Because you know what it is? It's still developing. I mean, it's the Bundesliga, so in a sense it always is.
The only thing I want to put out there is obviously Steffen Baumgart. We did mention it on Monday, but we actually chopped it for time. But he's leaving Paderborn in the season. And I want him to come to Hertha. Hope Freddie Bobic will get straight on the phone to Stefan, whose wife works in the Union fan shop. And obviously he was at Union. His last gig before Paderborn was coaching in the Regionalliga for a Berlin side. So like, bring him home, Freddie. Bring him back to the big city.
Vibes.
Anything else we need to shout out before we bounce?
No, we're all good, I think. We're all good.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
I've only got one more thing to say. Getting in the mood, Muta. I'm in the mood for Europa. It's Thursday. What else are we gonna do? All right, let's get out of here.
Let's do it.
Hope everyone's staying safe and well. Check Righty's House if you haven't already. Check theringer.com/soccer. Some pieces going up about the four Clásicos. Moose's book is out today.
It is.
If you can, go and buy it. Support your shy, humble poet.
Friendly neighborhood podcaster.
Don't forget to check the Stadio Outros playlist on Spotify. Speaking of which, we're playing out this episode on Belva Yin, Relatos de Praga. It's got a bit of like Giretti column energy, this one, I think. Anything else? Any agenda you want to push, Musa?
Not this week, no.
No? I think I'll taking give a week off from
my commercial agenda.
Tim Paul Hattie. Yeah. Nice. Have a lovely weekend, everyone. Much love, and we'll be back on Monday.
See ya.